I'm John Kroll. Coming up on No Limits, we'll talk about the dangers of prescription drug abuse. We will discuss how the problem begins and the damage it does to people's lives. We will talk about all of this with our guests, Dr. Amy Peake of the Butler University College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, Brad Banks of the Marion County Prosecutor's Office, and Tobin Linton, Fairbanks Adult Program Services Manager. And, of course, you. You can join the conversation by calling us toll-free at 1-866-476-3881, emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending comments or questions via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Please do join the discussion. First, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about the dangers of prescription drug abuse. We're fortunate to have as our guests Dr. Amy Peake, the Butler University College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Amy, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Very nice to be here.
It's good to have you here. Brad Banks, who is Division Supervisor for the Marion County Prosecutor's Office. Brad, welcome to the program.
Thank you, and good afternoon.
Good to have you here. And Tobin Linton, Fairbanks Adult Program Services Manager. Off the air, I was telling Tobin that I'm going to screw that up at least once during the show. Tobin, good to have you here.
Thanks. You did fine.
Oh, good. Good to see I made it through. I'd like to invite everyone, our listeners, to join the program by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You also can send an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or send comments or questions via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I want to start first by asking, and I'll start first with, we're going to take it around the horn, but I'll start first with Amy Peake. How widespread is this problem? I mean, how big a problem are we talking about when we talk about prescription drug abuse?
Prescription drug abuse is truly a huge problem all over the United States as well as here in Indiana. If you look at adolescents and young people, it's second only to the use of marijuana. It is really probably the biggest drug problem from our perspective in the United States and right now.
And from the law enforcement perspective, how big a problem is it, Brad?
Sure, and you know, we can't talk outside of law enforcement, but because it's so prevalent in what we do, it's probably an indicator of what a larger problem it is. There's definitely a variety of different crimes that I think you could tie back to
such
prescription
as?
Drug. Well, you know, everything from drunk driving to thefts, because you've got to either pay a doctor if you've gotten that angle going, or you've got to pay the guy on the street, to prescription fraud, where somebody's forging the name of a doctor, or they're taking a prescription and actually changing the number of refills, or changing the number of pills that were originally prescribed. So it's a wide range.
How often does that happen, where people are changing the prescriptions?
That happened quite frequently. That is lessened to some extent because the doctors are getting smarter and the technology is getting smarter. You're seeing a lot more electronic prescriptions written, or the doctor will fill the prescription directly to the pharmacy and not even give the patient a written prescription.
Okay.
So that's lessened over time, but it still happens. I mean, there's still the, you know, I guess the older generation of doctors who like to write the prescription on the pad. And anytime you do that, I mean, when you're just circling a number or you're writing a number, you know,
particularly if your handwriting's not all that good. Easy to. Amy's nodding her head up and down here in recognition here as the doctor on the panel. And one more sort of follow up. What is the penalty for something like that? If you forged a prescription, what are the?
Sure, prescription fraud is a D-felony. If there's a forgery where you actually have forged a doctor's name, it's a C-felony. D-felony carries up to 3 years in prison. The C felony, or if you actually were to write out a doctor's name, could carry a penalty up to 8 years.
Okay, so substantial penalties
absolutely
for doing this sort of stuff. How large a problem are we talking about with prescription drug abuse, Tobin Linton?
I've got to agree with the other guests. You know, from the treatment's perspective, when you're looking at the number of people who actually seek treatment and follow through with treatment, it's really just the tip of the iceberg of those who actually have the problem. So it is a vast, widespread issue that we're dealing with.
And how do people get to this point where, you know, they've is it because they've been sick and or had some sort of health problem and come to be reliant on prescription drugs, or is it something they think there's a way I can do this and not have to deal with, you know, street dealers and all of that sort of stuff? I mean, Tobin, could you take me through the steps? Because I have a feeling you deal with a fair number of these folks in terms of your treatment.
Essentially, it boils down to two different pathways. One we can call more legitimate and one less legitimate, I guess. So someone might present with a physician and be prescribed a prescription, whether it's a sedative or a painkiller, because essentially those are two different classifications for substances. And it could very well, you know, through a variety of factors and circumstances over the years or months, depending again on each case, could turn into an abuse and dependence problem. The other is more seen, I would say, for younger people who use substances. It's a curiosity. It's, hey, my parents or grandparents might have this XYZ drug in the cabinet and I'll try it out. No, that made me feel good and my friends are talking about it. So essentially it's you know that curiosity route or through more legitimate
Well, and it
stages.
Sounds like also it's what's available too.
Sure.
There's access to it in ways that at least initially don't seem to carry some of the risks that others face. Is it a larger problem than it used to be? Brad Banks, and then I'll bring it back to Amy Peake.
When you say used to be, I guess in context of
I'm an
15,
old guy.
20 years ago?
I'm an old guy, so I've got
absolutely. I think, though, probably I would say, and they can probably say from the treatment side, in the last 10 years, you've seen it really increase, and I think it's kind of hit a peak, if you will, but it's a high peak. Mm-hmm. It's certainly hasn't gotten any better, but it's been a pretty serious problem, I'd say, for at least the last 10 years.
Amy Peake.
I would definitely agree, and I think there's a couple of factors with that. I think that easy access is probably the single biggest factor, easier access, as well as the significant misconception that some people have that a prescription drug by default is a safer option than an illicit drug, right? And then because it's prescribed, it's got to be okay.
Yeah,
and
morphine can be prescribed.
Absolutely. And I do think that a lot of times when we talk about prescription drug abuse, people think, oh, OxyContin. And while that has had a significant, what I see more of are hydrocodone-based products, Vicodin, things like that. And especially in the college age community, I see a huge issue with stimulants that maybe people would be getting to typically treat ADD or something like that, and large numbers of abuse of things like Ritalin, Adderall, amphetamine type products, not just painkillers.
Why is that? What are they doing with them?
Well, it's legal speed. You feel good if you're a young woman. You don't eat. They use it for weight loss. A lot of really smart kids believe they need it to study. They believe it helps them perform better. So we're seeing, at least on college campuses, this whole different type of use of products that weren't prescribed to them, but not to get high, because this group of very highly competitive young people who think this will help me perform better, more of a performance enhancement in terms of academics or business world. So it's an interesting kind of crossroads of not just looking at abusing narcotics, but really using and abusing amphetamines and similar products.
Well, and that's something that, you know, in my other world as a college professor, I've thought almost of it as an urban folk tale, that you'd have college students taking their younger siblings' ADD medication so that they could prepare and focus more for a test. And what what you're saying is it's not an urban folktale. It's happening. So
I agree.
I want to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or sending a question, emailing us a question at nolimits@wfyi.org. You also can send comments or questions via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. And we've gotten a question from Robert Hubbard via Facebook, in which he says, it might be important to begin by drawing the difference between use and abuse. I'm just going to have to scan the rest of this real quickly. It says, so we can stick to the subject, let's point out, he makes a distinction also that in some cases they're talking about self-medicating and that this can lead to, Bruce, could we talk about at what point use does become abuse, where those lines should be drawn? And I'll start with Tobin Linton on that one.
Yeah, in the treatment world, you hear oftentimes the phrase slippery slope. And going off of what Dr. Peek was saying, it can very much easily start out very innocently to enhance performance, to relax as far as the downer type drugs go, or exceed expectations as far as some of the upper drugs go. But from there, it literally takes on a life of its own. We have certain manuals and reference guides to help us distinguish between abuse, dependence, appropriate use. But as one transitions, so to speak, from one phase to the next, it's a very blurry line. So, you know, an example of misuse might be someone misusing the prescription, either by taking more, allowing another person whose name is not on the script to use their medication, using someone else's medication that's prescribed specifically to that other person. So the lines get blurry. And again, based on the outcome of that one use, some positive things honestly can happen, whether feeling good or, you know, acing a test. And so from there, it grows and reinforces itself and takes on a life of its own.
Well, and I guess that point, is it against the law, for example, Brad Banks, if to use Tobin's example, if Amy has got a prescription for a painkiller and I'm having back spasms, I realize, and Amy is my friend and says to me, oh, why don't you take one of these and it'll go away. Have we broken the law if I take a drug that is prescribed for her?
Yes, I mean, technically you have. Obviously that's the case we almost never see because, yeah, you know, who's reporting that? But Indiana has a kind of a weird distinction that the actual use of a drug is not illegal. It's always the possession. So if you are possessing a narcotic without a valid prescription, that's the crime. So, you know, when you talk about handing the one pill to your neighbor because they've got a bad back that day, technically the minute that they take a possession of that pill, they've committed a crime. But, you know, we're almost never going to see that instance, which, you know, to some degree might be, we don't want to criminalize everything, but, you know, there is something to, that may be where you're nipping a problem in the bud in some instances. And we don't get in the picture usually until way after there's a problem.
Well, and I don't want to take us too far down this tangent.
Sure.
As I can see, but so just so I understand the distinction, is it's illegal if I'm going to stop picking on Amy here in a moment, but using her as my example, but it's a crime the minute it's in my hand. Does it stop being a crime the minute I ingest it then? Or is it?
Well, I mean,
that is a strange law.
It is, you know, if we just had a dirty screen of a probationer, for example, theoretically, we knew they had to have possessed it to have that in their system, but we're not going to charge them for the possession because possession is such a, you know, did they have it in the hand? Was it, you know, and it's one of those where we really have to catch them kind of actively possessing it. So they got an unlabeled pill bottle or a baby aspirin container or what have you that's filled with narcotic drugs. Then that's the kind of person that's going to get a charge because they're actually possessing it without a valid prescription at that point.
That we are talking about prescription drug abuse here on No Limits with our guests, Dr. Amy Peake, the Butler University College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, Brad Banks, Division Supervisor for the Marion County Prosecutor's Office, and Tobin Linton, Fairbanks Adult Program Services Manager. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking about prescription drug abuse with our guest, Dr. Amy Peake, Butler University College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, Brad Banks, who is the Division Supervisor of the Marion County Prosecutor's Office, and Tobin Linton, Fairbanks Adult Program Services Manager. That's three times I've made it through that.
Bet in a thousand.
I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or sending a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Amy, you were making a point here that our listener Robert Hubbard, who'd sent the Facebook comment, had a serious point to make, and when we were talking during the break, you had some things to say, so I want to invite you to say those on the air so that people can listen to them.
Sure. I really do think there's a legitimate point to be made and a distinction. If, let's say, someone is using a painkiller because they had maybe an acute medical procedure where pain was expected for a short period of time and ended. So let's say maybe you had some dental work done, you needed to take something for pain for a period of maybe 2 to 3 days. When that is over, that acute period is over, there shouldn't be a need for medication any longer. And if a person is still seeking medication after those first few days, that could be a flag that there's a problem. And I think that's a really significant distinction between someone who has legitimate chronic pain, and we don't do a great job of treating chronic pain. There aren't a lot of medications that are safe and efficacious and treat the source of the problem. Because in reality, when we use narcotics to treat chronic pain, we aren't treating the source of the problem. We are altering the way we perceive pain. And that might make the person more functional, but down the road, these medications do cause both dependence and tolerance. So tolerance means you need more of the drug to get the same effect. And dependence means you feel crappy when you stop taking it. Mm-hmm. So in the cases of people who have legitimate chronic pain, we really do have challenges of trying to, how do we best control their pain? And at what point, if a person truly is quote unquote addicted, do I care? If I have a person who is an end-stage cancer patient, I really truly don't care if they're addicted to pain meds. If I have a young person who had an automobile accident, mm-hmm, and we need to get them on with the rest of their life, we care if they get addicted to pain medications. We need to manage that type of pain in a different way.
Tobin Linton, I saw you doing an eyebrow lift when Amy Peake said that she didn't care if there was an addiction issue in that specific circumstance of being a late-stage cancer.
Sure. I'm patient. Surprised you caught that, John.
They pay me to pay attention, so... That's what I try to do.
Well, I just wanted to clarify, I guess, the issue of functionality. Mm-hmm. Once drug use begins to impair one's ability to carry out day-to-day activities, and they need more and they're following along that path, that's when it becomes a problem. And now, I guess I reacted to the late-stage terminal cancer patient. Not a lot of responsibilities, not a lot of activities that he or she might be responsible for. So that quality of life essentially is alleviating as much pain to make things as functional for that person as possible. So that's...
And we're wandering away. To some degree, we're getting into the,
right,
you know, end of life of ethical questions, right, there too, which is, while it would be a great show, it's not this show. We've gotten another comment from a Facebook comment from a listener. It says, please discuss the problem of disposing of prescription drugs appropriately, especially those that are likely to be abused. For example, we have drugs, some treating ADHD, remaining that haven't worked but have no place to dispose of them safely and conveniently. What is the appropriate way to deal with outdated prescription drugs?
That is a fabulous question, because right now the current law indicates that a controlled substance cannot be given to another individual. So that also means, as a pharmacist, I legally today can't take that back and dispose of it safely. I can take any non-controlled, but I can't take a controlled substance safely back today. In Indiana, though, that is going to be changing. There are new laws which gave the Indiana State Board of Pharmacy the directive to make guidelines for pharmacies to be able to take back controlled substances. And the way we are going to be allowed to do that is actually President Obama is there has been a recent amendment to the Food and Drug Administration to a law that allows us to remove law enforcement from the take back and safe legitimate disposal loop. So my answer today is that to look for controlled substances disposal programs through your county solid waste disposal agencies. Marsh Pharmacies are a place also that often has several times a year take back programs, many times at some of the state fairs and the county fairs. I know in Hendricks County, we do it at the county fair in conjunction with our law enforcement partners over the county fair times, and we have sheriff's officers with us. And then the safest way to dispose them is incineration, which through those take back programs is what we do.
So should you, if you don't want to take them back or they're not at convenient times, I mean, is burning them yourself, is that legal or appropriate, or is that?
It would depend on what it is. If it's anything that contains alcohol or flammable, I would highly not recommend that.
Yeah, at least do it at a safe distance. Right.
But, technically, some places say to flush them down the toilet. I do not agree with that. But
why not? Why shouldn't they run?
Because it gets in our drinking water, and our sewage supplies are not such that are designed to filter out medications.
So running them down a garbage disposal then also doesn't solve the problem.
It solves the diversion problem.
Okay.
It creates an environmental problem. So what we actually recommend is to mix them with something undesirable, like used kitty litter, for example, or something else.
That would be undesirable.
And put them in a container, wrap the container in duct tape, and dispose of them honestly through the trash, because a sealed landfill is actually a more environmentally safe disposal option than flushing them down the toilet.
Okay. Well, that sounds – I would not have thought of the putting them together with kitty litter, I guess, used kitty litter, and disposing of it that way. Mary Ann, welcome to the program. How are you doing today? Mary Ann, are you with us? Well, we will see if we can get Mary Ann here in just a moment. I wanted to ask, really, with this, I mean, how much of the problem from your perspective, Brad Banks, is that a lot of these drugs are just floating around and that they aren't disposed of appropriately, so you create opportunity for law breaking.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, this is somewhat anecdotal. I think it probably the extra floating around causes a couple problems, and that is, one, some people, especially the younger crowd, start abusing by getting that relative who left his extra 10 pain pills in a bottle in an old medicine cabinet. The other part where it causes a problem is the addict, who maybe started on a legitimate, but doctor's no longer prescribing it. That's where they start looking next. Families will start finding that their legitimate drugs have come up missing. And that's where, if you have that extra, it really can make a difference to not leave it laying around.
Where it can be, almost like guns, really, or anything else that's dangerous. You
absolutely
need to keep them locked up. Mary Ann, welcome to the program. How are you doing today?
Fine, thanks. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you for joining us. I understand you have a question really about how they maintain sort of security measures at pharmacies to make sure that people aren't bouncing from one pharmacy to another.
Right. It seems to me that it would be so simple if every pharmacy was required to record social security numbers, so that if a patient came in with, say, his fifth prescription for Vicodin, they'd know right away by looking at his social security number. and not just within CVS or Walgreens. It would be recorded in all pharmacies all across state or whatever.
We do that. It isn't via Social Security number because of a lot of security reasons for that. But there are two ways. One, Indiana has a program called Inspect, and it is a transmittal to a central repository in the state of Indiana that we can see every controlled substance this individual has filled at any pharmacy anywhere. So I can, if I have a question or a concern, I can go online and see, oh, well, it wasn't filled at my Marsh, but it was filled at the Walgreens down the street. And then it was filled. Sometimes I can even see, like, literally a line across I-70 or up I-65 where they have gone. So that is in place. And the other thing is, if they try to run it through their insurance programs, insurance companies won't pay for it too soon. And I will get a rejection from an insurance company that tells me exactly where it was filled on what date and when, even if it wasn't in my pharmacy. So those actually do exist, but it isn't illegal to have three prescriptions from three different doctors. What is illegal is for, maybe you should comment more on legality,
but from
the standpoint of, you know, me looking out for my best interest and the best interest of the patient, I often will go to inspect and see where did they get this. And then I'll call the prescribing physician back and say, were you aware that Dr. So-and-so prescribed the same medication 4 days ago? And they'll say, oh, no, I had no idea. Make that prescription void. So that does exist.
Well, and that's I'm going to toss this out and see who wants to bite at it. But really, whose responsibility is it to police all of that stuff? Because it sounds like Marianne's question is a valid one, that there's a lot of information out there, but no place where it's being collected or monitored. Brad Banks, it would seem that you would get the first bite at this apple, but...
Well, I mean, I think, and the other two panelists may be able to provide information on this, where the pharmacies have that, I don't believe physicians do. Or if they do, I've certainly seen circumstances where it didn't appear to have been used very well. I mean, I recently was involved in a deposition where through discovery through a hospital, we found out about a number of prescriptions the defendant was on, and we were deposing one of her primary care physicians, and he knew nothing about what the other doctors had prescribed or that she was even seeing a doctor. So I don't know if a similar system could be put in place with for doctors where they could cross-reference a centralized system. I suppose then you're going to get into some privacy issues on the medical and HIPAA laws that would cloud that a little bit.
There are some civil liberties concerns.
Absolutely.
That are being raised. But I guess, Tobin, I would raise the question, since you probably deal with this as a medical situation,
yeah,
dealing with patients, I mean... Is that set of circumstances that we've sort of laid out here where, say, you do have an addiction problem and presumably the means to do all of this stuff, you will find a way to have visits with four or five different doctors so you can get four or five different prescriptions and the doctors don't know about it?
Absolutely. And I think... It's as technology advances, it's becoming more difficult for individuals to go that route. But I want to make a couple of comments.
Sure.
One is that people who are physically dependent, people who are addicted to, you know, whatever medication it is, become extremely invested in maintaining that supply of medication, those drugs, in order to continue the feeling that they get for that. So they become very creative. Sometimes individuals become manipulative. So while I think that it helps to go that route and have that monitoring and have that those extra safeguards in place, you know, addiction is a powerful thing, and people become, like I said, very creative, very manipulative. Sometimes they become violent in order to maintain that status quo. Change is difficult. Change can be scary. So at Fairbanks, we do our very best to take advantage of those inspect reports. I know I've been in on more than one meeting where our physicians have ordered an inspect report, and we cross-reference. We you know, any patient that comes through the door signs a release to their primary care physician, and anyone who might be prescribing any type of habit-forming prescription medication, and we make a call with a patient in order to cut off those supply lines as much as we can. To so to speak, burn those bridges so that we're not treating and detoxing the patient and get him to a healthy medical stability, and then turn right around and, oh, well, I'm going to go fill my prescription again just to get back to the mess that was there prior to coming in for treatment. So we do what we can to avoid any opportunities to go back to the way things were prior to treatment.
Well, and I want to pick up on Brad's point and throw this back to Amy Peake a little bit. He suggested perhaps there ought to be a network linking doctors as well as pharmacies. Is I think the only doctor on the panel right now. Would there be an objection to doing that, or would there be problems with that approach?
Any
or?
Pharmacist and physician who registers with Inspect is able to see that information. The challenge is there's no mandate to look at that. So if you look in a busy physician's office, he or she would have to take time to leave the room with the patient, to go to a computer, to bring up the Inspect website, to put in that patient's information, to get that information. So it's really more of an issue of educating physicians, A, that it's available, B, how to use it. And if they know in advance that that patient is coming, maybe they could have one of their staff run that and have that available to them before that person comes in the door. So maybe some of that is really more of a educational aspect with our physician partners in this challenge to help do a better job. And even just things like if you have an acute pain situation, maybe not by default prescribing 50 Vicodin at a time when you really think they're only going to need 15. So there's definitely, I think, some avenues that we could go through that are physician education and partnership avenues, not just treatment and law enforcement. And I think that's what makes this type of drug abuse so much more challenging than illicit drug abuse, because it's really more the abuser and law enforcement. When it's prescription drug abuse, there's so many other faucets and avenues to go through with that it really gets very challenging and complicated.
Tobin Linton, I'm going to ask you kind of a complicated question in a relatively short time. We've got to answer it here, but I want to ask, at what point do people begin to realize with prescription drugs that they might have a problem? At what point, I guess, basically, do they come to see you? And what motivates them? Is it someone pushing them to do it, or is it that suddenly they look around and think, oh boy,
sure,
I'm in a place where I do not want to be.
Yeah, the pressure's on to answer that one because you know there are multiple situations where people never realize that they have a problem, and you know, unfortunately, they end up expiring or you know, having some long-term type of difficulty. But yeah, people come to us in many different ways, whether it's internal motivation, whether it's external motivation, and we take all comers. You know, at Fairbanks, we want to do what we can to help folks. I'd say that the biggest motivator right off the bat for a lot of people is taking the pain away and removing pain. So we start with that and through motivational enhancement and other therapeutic techniques, do our very best to help send people in the right direction.
We are talking about prescription drug abuse with our guest, Dr. Amy Peake, Butler University College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, Brad Banks, who is the Division Supervisor for the Marion County Prosecutor's Office, and Tobin Linton, Fairbanks Adult Program Services Manager. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about prescription drug abuse with our guests, Dr. Amy Peake, Butler University College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, Brad Banks, who is Division Supervisor, Marion County Prosecutor's Office, and Tobin Linton, Fairbanks Adult Program Services Manager. I'm going to get all the way through the program without screwing that up. That'll be good. And I would like to invite our listeners to join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, sending us an email at WFYI, or at nolimits@WFYI.org, or via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Want to ask a question, because in some ways what we're talking about here, just the idea that prescription drug abuse is a problem, is a relatively recent phenomenon, and that, you know, at least in my layman's understanding of this, and I'm inviting correction on this, that's part of what, like, the Betty Ford Centers and all of that sprang up to deal with, because we dealt with the kind of perception Amy referred to early on in the program, that if it's been prescribed, it's okay, it's safe, you're cool, it's not a problem. And now we realize, well, just because it's been prescribed, if you don't follow the instructions, it can be a problem. All sorts of ways that this can be a problem. I guess what I want to go with is, going around the line, I'll start with Amy. Are pharmacists now being trained differently than they would have been, say, 40 years ago, to deal with this problem specifically?
I mean, it is, and we're trained what to do when you have a gun in your face. That, mm-hmm. I mean, that's something that pharmacists who were trained 30 or 40 years ago isn't part of the training, you know. But the reality is that when you were talking about earlier what types of crimes does prescription drug abuse lead to, from my world, you know, there's many, many pharmacy robberies every day, all over in Indiana as well. You don't see them all on the news, but, you know, we look at it from a personal safety perspective. Mm-hmm. What do we do when that situation happens? And then certainly beyond that.
And what do you tell them to do in that situation?
We give them, I mean, they're not there to hurt us.
Yeah.
They're there because they want drugs. So in the crime world, we're
give
in a good
the drugs
spot.
And call
That's
the police.
Exactly what you do.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Every pharmacy has a panic button. So I push the panic button as discreetly as I can, and I hope that they really view that as a panic and send the police at that time. But there's also, we have to address what the person in front of us, because if we truly believe there is a person who is in withdrawal, they're very adamant. Mm-hmm. We're talking about, they do very creative things, very motivated to get those medications. If they're in front of me and they have a refill available and I'm concerned about that, I have to also weigh my personal safety, because there's a possibility that they could do something to me, to the other customers in there. But we definitely want to look at it from a partnership with the prescribers and with our mental health facilities. There seems to be a huge challenge that there are fewer and fewer mental health facilities available in the big picture. Lots of the state-sponsored programs are no longer available, and we're seeing people with more significant illnesses being treated as outpatients, and maybe not being adequately treated from a lack of provider standpoints as well. So trying to partner with places like Fairbanks and other types of care providers. So I think that there's really a lot of aspects to this, but treatment, and especially for people who are uninsured, treatment mm-hmm. Is a huge, huge, huge challenge for us.
Brad Banks, how differently do you train people in law enforcement now to deal with, I mean, this would, just in the brief discussion we've had so far, clearly there are nuances to the law that have to be observed here.
Sure.
Is it different from the way we would have trained law enforcement officials 30 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, from a police perspective, they certainly have there's new challenges that come with any type of new addictions that are out there. I think from the corrections perspective is where the attitudes are changing somewhat. There's a new program in the Department of Corrections. If somebody's sentenced to the Department of Corrections, they have 1,700 beds across the state. It gives you an idea of how many opportunities that they see as a need, where they go in and they're amongst only other people that have similar problems or similar addictions, and they are treated every single day for approximately a 9-month period of time. And if they can successfully complete that program, they'll get 6 months taken off of their their sentence. Those programs, and this program is only a year old. Mm-hmm. Those are the kind of things that you're seeing from a law enforcement perspective that are changing. Because a normal guy that just goes to prison and is put in the normal prison routine may go to a class a week or may go to a class for an hour a week. This is a situation where literally the minute they wake up, they're involved in treatment till the time they go to bed. And it's very stringent. And if you don't comply, then you rejoin that regular prison crowd. So that I think that's where we're seeing the biggest change, if you will, from a law enforcement perspective is how to balance the need to have that community safety, because you know if they've robbed at gunpoint a pharmacy, that's a dangerous situation because things can go wrong and people can get shot and killed. Versus while we're doing that, addressing the root of the problem, which is the addiction.
Tobin Linton, are in your field, are people trained differently than they would have been 30 years ago to deal specifically with this problem, and how so?
Absolutely. People are trained differently. It wasn't too long ago and still exists to this day that treatment, I'll use air quotes here, was very in your face, very confrontational. It was break down the self-esteem and you know with the idea to rebuild from there by plugging in different techniques and coping skills and things along those lines. That is not the case today. At Fairbanks, we're
that almost sounds like emotional cruelty.
It borders on that. And there were those anecdotal cases where it proved effective. So folks were like, hey, we don't know any better. Let's keep going with what quote unquote works. But over the years, we've become more educated on exactly neurotransmission processes, how addiction works, the different relapse prevention techniques that go along once someone has entered into treatment. So we are becoming smarter as a field. We're becoming a more professional field to where we bring in factors for consideration when we're educating patients, when we're training counselors to take a more non-judgmental approach, a more motivation enhancement, building with strengths, and then going with that to see what can be nurtured and flourish from there.
Mike, welcome to the program. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Thank you for calling us. We're actually running a little bit tight on time, so if I could ask you to ask your question pretty quickly, that would probably be to the good. You still there, Mike? Mike? Okay, well, we will see if we can resolve that for a second. Mike, as I understand it, and I'm going to sort of frame the subject here, has asked a question about what responsibility doctors have in regard to this problem and how they, how they should be held accountable, if they should be held accountable at all. I'll throw that first to Amy Peek, you seem to be getting all the hot shots today. And then over to Brad Banks, because to some degree there's a legal component to all of that too.
I think that we all share the responsibility, pharmacists, physicians, patients, counselors, all of us. But with that said, treating chronic pain and other types of those types of medications or angiolytics or other types of those drugs, we don't have a quick, easy test for it. If you have high blood pressure, I can measure your blood pressure and treat you accordingly. If you have high cholesterol, I have a very objective test that tells me that. With something like pain or anxiety or depression, there is no objective test. I simply have to take your word for what you tell me. So when patients are being very manipulative in an area where there is really nothing objective measurement testing-wise that can be done to do that, it's really challenging. So, and again, the chronic pain versus the acute pain are very different. If there's a situation where that pain should have stopped based on that type of injury or surgery or whatever happened, that's a very different situation if you continue to prescribe versus a situation where a person has a legitimate long-term chronic pain situation because we don't have many options on how to manage that.
Well, let me ask, though, a kind of a devil's advocate question, and I am going to bring it back to Brad Banks for the legal answer on that. But suppose I am a doctor, and I'll pick on Tobin this time instead of Amy, because Amy's been abused more than enough during this program. And Tobin is in my office, and he's showing some behaviors that indicate to me that there is some sort of addiction problem there, and that I strongly suspect that it may be he's abusing prescription drugs. What are my ethical responsibilities as a doctor at that point? And then I'm going to throw it to Brad and ask what my legal responsibilities are. But Amy, I'll go with you first. Ethically, what should I be doing if I strongly suspect here that Tobin is abusing drugs? Which he is not. I want to offer that disclaimer. I do not. I do not. This is a fictional exercise here.
Well, number one, I would look at what is their comfort zone with treating addictions. That in reality, most general practitioners do not have a large comfort zone and experience level of treating addictions. So if I am at that point, I really should strongly consider a referral to someone who is a specialist in the management of addictions. And there are also many areas that are truly pain management centers that do nothing but control chronic pain. So if it truly has a legitimate component to it, but has developed into something more, I would honestly try to take that out of a general practitioner's environment and put it into a pain management specialist environment, as well as potentially an addiction specialist environment. So,
what is Tobin?
I was just going
to
say,
and not just to defend yourself, I presume.
Not this time, no.
Okay.
Right. At Fairbanks, we are looking into initiatives to partner with primary care physicians and different offices to have those resources available, because we not only want to provide services for patients, we want to be the go-to people, the experts in addictions. For a variety of different audiences, so to speak. So, physicians, primary care physicians, treatment, centers around the state. That's what we're looking at.
Well, and I guess I think it's implicit in your answer, Amy. But am I under an ethical obligation as that doctor again? If I think someone's doing that. If you're talking about referring someone, do I have an obligation then to say to that patient, I think you may have a problem?
Absolutely.
And that's really where I was going at the most basic level.
And I think that doesn't necessarily mean that the most responsible thing is cutting their supply off right then.
Yeah.
That I think there's some misconception in the community that a reputable physician would do that. And I don't professionally agree with that, because if you have someone who's truly an addict, cold turkey in the community is not the best option. It really isn't. So,
well, and I'm going to take the conversation over to Brad here, and we'll shift it a little bit to make everyone a little more comfortable. I will be the suspected addict, and Tobin will be the doctor here. And Brad, in that situation, if Tobin thinks that I have a problem, does he have a legal obligation to notify law enforcement that someone may be abusing prescription drugs?
No, and I think that's going to get back to the physician-patient privileges, because we don't want to put doctors or patients, either one, in a situation where the patient's afraid to report to their doctor, or the doctor's afraid to inquire of the patient. And that's the problem with involving the criminal system, and especially on the doctor's side, because we don't want the result to be, well, then I'm just not going to deal with patients that have that problem.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And from the civil side, if you get into malpractice type questions, that goes through a review panel of other physicians, and then they're looking at, did the doctor act within reasonable medical standards? And I think this is probably one of the trickiest areas for physicians, because they have that pressure of seeing a patient in 30 minutes, And, you know, to really address that type of an issue in such a short period of time, it would be difficult. And so I don't think we want to hold physicians, you know, certainly not criminally responsible in that situation, because we want them to, you know, they still have a business to maintain, and we don't want them to be afraid to engage with their patients.
We've got just about a minute left, and I think actually, you know, as an informational program, we'd be guilty almost of malpractice if I didn't ask this kind of question and ask you to respond very, very quickly. If you think you have a prescription drug problem, what should you do? What's your first step? Start with Tobin.
I'm going to say call Fairbanks.
Well, that's okay. Shameless plugs are okay.
Yeah, the phone number, I'll go ahead and throw that out there, 317-849-8222, or our website is www.fairbankscd.org. Aside from the shameless plug there, I would say, you know, ask questions. Check in with other people. Look for areas of functioning. If you're not able to get up in the morning, if you're not able to go to sleep at night, if you know things are of your natural daily interactions with other people are being affected, or you know you become reliant on a substance in order to engage in those things, I'd start asking some questions.
I feel like we could continue talking about this for several more hours and still not exhaust the subject. I want to thank my guest, Dr. Amy Peek, Butler University College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences, for joining us. It's been a pleasure talking with you, Amy. Sorry if I gave you a hard time. Tobin Linton, Fairbanks Adult Program Services Manager. I made it all the way through the program. I apologize also if I gave you a hard time, but I'm glad you joined us on the program.
Good to be here.
And Brad Banks, who is the Division Supervisor for the Marion County Prosecutor's Office. Brad, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to thank all of our listeners, particularly those who called in or sent in comments or questions. We really enjoyed spending the time with you, and we will look forward to talking with you next week. Take care.
No Limits is a production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Jeanette Rhodes, and board engineer, Matthew Sosi. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m., and you can listen online at WFYI.org.